Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Right, good morning, everybody. Real pleasure to be here. As an alumni of a business school, it's a great privilege for me to be able to come back and talk to an audience like this. And I greatly enjoyed the conversation that we had last year, and I wanted some more. And what I want to do this morning is just follow up David Sweeney's contribution, which you heard about this morning. And what I'd like to do is just offer a few thoughts about you, about your impact, about the agenda that I think policymakers will want to see from you over the next 4 or 5 years. And what I want to do is really say a word about how we in the Labour Party see the work that you do and the next 4 or 5 years fitting into the wider story that we want to tell over the next 6 months in the run-up to the next election. Now, it was Ronald Reagan who famously said that hard work never killed anybody, but I figure, why take the chance? But the reality for most people in our country today is that hard work pays a lot less than it used to, and it is an awful lot harder to make a decent living for you and for your family by working hard. The most important fact that will be on the agenda over the next 5 to 6 months is the basic truth that in our country today, families are now £1,600 a year worse off than they were at the last election. What that means is that for all of the changes in trade and technology and productivity and growth and innovation over the last few years haven't lifted the living standards of ordinary families in our country. And to use a phrase that pollsters are fond of, that is why families in this country are pretty pissed off. And that is why they're looking for a radical set of options from political parties at this next election. Now, as you will know, what underlies this basic problem with living standards is a profound crisis in British productivity. There is now a 20% gap between the productivity of the UK on the one hand, and our competitors in the G7. So in effect, to simplify, what that means is that what the rest of the G7 finished making on a Thursday night takes us until the end of Friday. It is very, very difficult to raise wage rates and to boost pay packets when there is a productivity gap that is that big. Strategically, what that means for us in the Labour Party is basically one way out. The only thing that you can do in a situation where you have got such pressure on productivity on the one hand and such pressure on pay on the other is simple. You have to build a bigger knowledge economy. Today, the knowledge economy in Britain is about a third of GDP. It's about a third of businesses. It's only about 19% of jobs. Now, if it was a third of jobs, there would be an extra 2.5 million high-skilled jobs in our country. What are they worth? Well, on average, a job in the knowledge economy, depending on how you define it, is worth 40% more pay over and above the national average. And I guarantee that if I put a 40% pay rise on the table in front of you this morning, if you weren't a Member of Parliament, you'd probably have to take it. So what you will hear from Labour over the next 4 or 5 months are a range of arguments, policies and strategies for how we build that bigger knowledge economy here in our country. And you have heard from me over the last 2 or 3 months two lines of argument in particular, which are very important. One is about science and the other is about skills. If you look at some of the potential that we have to build a bigger knowledge economy in Britain, if you look at the years ahead, if you look at some of the market sizes that people are forecasting, you can see just how much opportunity there is in the years to come. So analysts think that the Internet of Things is going to be a £4.5 billion industry by 2017. People think wearable tech will be a £43 billion industry by 2024. Big data and analytics will be worth £20 billion by 2017. Driverless cars will be worth £17 billion by 2020. There are big new markets which are opening up around the world and indeed here in Europe. And what we have got to do is ensure that businesses and industries in Britain are well placed to profit as those new markets grow. That means that we have to become have to reinforce our position as one of the world's best place to do science. And I mean science in its broadest sense. That kind of multidisciplinary strategic research that is so important, not just in delivering curiosity-based breakthroughs, but ensuring that those breakthroughs actually get translated into real change in the world, that is something at which we are outstanding in this country. But we are in one hell of a race. China will spend something like $2.15 trillion on research and development over the course of this five-year plan. There are some people, and I have arguments with many of them, who believe that the indigenous innovation capacity in China is somehow flawed and weak. This is an analysis that Chinese leaders have in the past shared, but that is why they are so determined to ensure that there is change over the next 10 years. China is seeking to become an innovation economy by 2020 and one of the world's leading science powers by 2050. And if anything, my guess is that they will achieve those targets not late, but early. If you now look at the 10 major science and tech clusters around China, you see some of the most extraordinary advances on Earth. When Steve Jobs, of course, was thinking about where he was going to build Apple and the new iPad and the new iPhone, he was told that to put together the team of engineers that he needed in California would take him 6 or 7 months. His partners in China were able to put together a similar team in about 6 weeks. If you look at companies like Huawei or Alibaba or Tencent or Sina Weibo, you're beginning to see now Chinese companies pioneer the art of taking breakthroughs all over the world, combine them, develop them, and enhance them into something more. Or look at what is happening in Germany. Germany has always been clear that its edge in the world is based on its investment in science and technology. That is why there is such a strong cross-party consensus about getting R&D up to 3% of GDP. One of the surprising things for me when I was in Berlin earlier this year is hearing from SPD politicians about just how widely that ambition across the political spectrum is shared in Germany. And in Germany's trade figures, you can see month in, month out, the results of that investment. A sharp contrast, I have to say, to the trade deficit here in this country. So if the race to the top is one thing, then it is a science race. As the Royal Society put it, unless we get smarter, we will get poorer. But it's a race in which Britain is now falling behind. And what bedevils much policy work for universities and for research leaders is the fact that we don't have a long-term plan for science and technology. We hope that we'll get one at the autumn statement, please God, but the fact that we have research going up, that's good, but the lack of a similar kind of settlement for revenue is a real problem. Research leaders across the UK are increasingly telling us now that, yes, it's getting more possible to get a big kit in place, but quite frankly, it's getting much harder to keep the lights on. So what we need to hear from the Chancellor at the autumn statement is a fresh look at how we have a ring fence for all science spending, how we put the whole thing on a 10-year programme, and how we take politicians out of the day-to-day policy making that I'm afraid we see all too often today. The other great challenge is, of course, skills. And this is where Tristram Hunt and I have talked a lot about how we do something big and important in our country over the next 10 years. German productivity overtook British productivity, sometime in the late 1960s, 1970s, and it reflected many of the changes that Germany made in its technical education system after the Second World War. They weren't changes that we made, and the result of that is that while we have an excellent world-class academic route to degree-level skills, we simply do not have the same thing for professional, technical, and vocational education. That is something which we are absolutely determined to change. And it's critical for business for one very simple reason. Businesses all over Britain are telling us they cannot expand because they simply cannot get the people. I see it firsthand in my own constituency because I represent the constituency in Britain that has got the highest youth unemployment anywhere. And yet I know a mile from the Bromford estate, in the north of my constituency, is the great plant of Jaguar Land Rover, where over the last few years they have had to import workers because they cannot get the skills in the city of Birmingham. That tells you that our system of professional and technical education in this country is broken. This year, we will send something like 14,000 apprentices on to degree-level skills. That's about 2% of apprentices in this country. So while we'll send something like 365,000 young people onto a traditional degree where only half of them will get a graduate-level job at the end of it and where nearly half will never repay their student debt, and those that do, it will take them until their 50s in order to pay it down, that is not a situation that is sustainable in Britain. We need a vocational, technical, professional path for degree-level skills in the way that we simply don't have right now. And so that's why what Tristram and I have talked about is vocational education that starts at the age of 14, that continues with English and maths for everybody up to the age of 18, a technical baccalaureate that would allow people the kind of prestigious qualification at that level, a match for A-levels. But what we've also said now is that we see our priority for expanding higher education as the creation of apprenticeship or technical degrees that allow people to earn while they learn. And we think that there will have to be institutional changes too, a different kind of relationship between universities and further education colleges, where it is much easier to transfer the credits that you earn at an FE college up into a degree level programme, and crucially, a much closer relationship with the business community. If you look at what's going on at the Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre at Sheffield or the Warwick Manufacturing Centre at Warwick, you're beginning to see innovative higher education leaders now putting the system back together. The great challenge with the hyper-marketised laissez-faire system that we've got in universities today is it is snapping the bonds of collaboration everywhere and replacing it with the fierce and cold winds of competition. It's not good enough, in our view, simply to have world-class institutions in higher education. We want a world-class tertiary system. Now, I believe passionately that this is a huge opportunity for business schools over the years to come. Very often, for many of the universities of which you're part, you will be one of the most important interfaces with business, and crucially, you'll be one of the most important platforms on which small and medium-sized enterprises come together. That is a big, big opportunity for you to move centre stage in the higher education debate over the next 5 or 6 years. Small businesses, you will know, are creating jobs 4 or 5 times faster than big business. If we don't have an apprenticeship system that allows people to go on to degree-level skills that works for SMEs, then we won't have a system that is really worth its name. Because of the relationships that you will often manage, I think that you will become much more important actors in putting this new system back together again. So, science and skills will be two of the most important parts of public policy in which I think you've got real scope to enhance and multiply your impact over the years to come. But as the chair of the All-Party Group on Inclusive Growth, I think that this is only part of the agenda to which you'll contribute. And this is where I just want to underline what David Sweeney said about impact. There is not really much of a debate now about whether the market economy needs to change. When I started business school in 1999, the first case study that we were taught in our ethics courses was all Milton Friedman's famous article about profit is the only purpose of business. Over the last 4 or 5 years, you have begun to see now very clear and distinct signs of what is a once-in-a-generation sea change in politics and in business. There is a wide recognition now, right the way across the business community and the finance community and the faith community and the political community, that things have got to be different in the years to come. We have now got reports from the IMF and the OECD and others saying that inequality and the level of inequality that we have today is bad for business and it is bad for growth. And so there is a great struggle now, a great intellectual struggle, bringing so many people from so many different backgrounds together as people search for this debate about a more inclusive model of growth for the years to come. I think that business schools are in an extraordinary position to be the epicentre of that debate over the next 4 or 5 years. The real hothouse for where the principles for a different kind of economy will be forged. Now, skills and science will be important parts of the argument, but there'll be four or five other parts of the argument that are important too. The first is, on the demand side, how we create bigger markets. This is something that Ed Miliband is going to talk about with the CBI a bit later on. In this kind of post-Doha world, what we're all searching for as policymakers now are how you put back together great free markets. You can see the Americans doing it in the Pacific. You see us in Europe doing it with TTIP, with the Americans. And what Ed will talk about today is the priority that we attach to remaining in the European Union, the greatest free market on earth. Countries that trade faster grow faster. That is why those who believe in inclusive growth need to focus harder on how we build a bigger demand side, how we build bigger global markets. Second, all of us know that we need our capital markets to become more patient. We know that markets have got to become far more entrepreneurial, which is why many of the entrepreneurs that you are training are so important in the future. We believe that where there is regulation that gets in the way of good outcomes for consumers, and where there's regulations that get in the way of more entrepreneurial behaviour, as there is in our energy market today, then things need to change. There are going to have to be changes in our tax system so that when companies make profits, they pay a fair share of them. And of course, we have to make sure that wealth is evenly shared and evenly generated across our United Kingdom, which is why the issue of spatial inequality and the issue of devolution is such an important agenda item for us. So if you put these things together, science and skills, patient capital, or entrepreneurial markets, changes to the tax system, changes around devolution, changes on the demand side, you've got an extremely big and an extremely rich policy debate where I think the leaders of tomorrow that you are training can get an awful lot more from the curricula that you deliver. As someone who spent most of my career in business, and has started a technology business before finding myself in the wrong place at the wrong time 10 years ago and getting elected to the House of Commons. And I have always been fascinated by some of the forgotten traditions in British capitalism. Some of these traditions are traditions on which you can help entrepreneurs and leaders for tomorrow draw as we try and get these debates right in the years to come. If you think about George Cadbury from my hometown of Birmingham and the extraordinary Quaker tradition and the extraordinary nonconformist tradition of British business that he epitomised, you see a different tradition of capitalism. If you look at the extraordinary achievement of William Lever in creating one of the world's first great brand-based multinationals and the different kind of business ethos that he tried to foster at Port Sunlight, you see a different tradition of British capitalism. If you look at, now their adverts are back on the television, if you look at the extraordinary tradition pioneered by John Speed and Lewis in creating a partnership model at what is now the biggest business on the British high street, you see a very different tradition of British capitalism. These are the kinds of stories and studies that we will need an awful lot more of over the next 4 or 5 years as politicians and policymakers in Britain, in Europe and in the world beyond struggle with a different kind of agenda. So I think you're going to be far more important to many of these debates than I think I've seen in the past. And I suppose my final note really is a political note to underline just how important it is that you get absolutely stuck in. When people are pessimistic about the future, they are full of fear. And when people are full of fear, they don't vote for progressive politics, whether it's in my party or any other mainstream party. They vote for parties who want to roll back the clock, shut down the shutters, and pretend that we can get off the world in some way. That is not a politics that is going to take us forward in this world. We don't know what this century's equivalent of the computer or the internet or the double helix is going to be. But we stand on the brink of one of the most extraordinary centuries in the history of science, technology, and human progress. Britain has to decide over the next 4 or 5 years whether we are going to be a big part of that century or whether we're going to be bystanders. Back in 1945, my favourite Labour politician, Clement Attlee, a man who had the best haircut in Labour history, said, "We need to face our future, not full of fear, but full of hope." That message is as true today as it was when he made his final broadcast to a world-weary nation in 1945. I think you're important to that sense of optimism over the years to come, and I look forward to working with you in turning that idea into reality. Thanks very much indeed.